I wanted to start with reading you something that is from the internet, so you always have to say, not so sure. Supposedly, these are statements that kids made as they were talking about the Bible, or written out statements, I guess, about the Bible that people thought were funny, and they put them together. You know how those things accumulate on the internet. So these are some, remember, these are children's comments about the Bible. Somebody said Noah's wife was called Joan of Arc. Samson slayed the Philistines with the axe, A-X-E. He slayed the Philistines with the axe of the apostles. Moses led the Hebrews to the Red Sea, where they made unleavened bread, which is bread without any ingredients. Solomon, one of David's sons, had 300 wives and 700 porcupines. Yeah. We'll just kind of leave that one to everybody's imagination. Jesus enunciated the golden rule, which says to do one to others before they do one to you. He also said, quote, a man does not live by sweat alone. The people who followed the Lord would call it 12 decibels. The epistles were the wives of the apostles. Actually, that one. That makes pretty good sense. Okay. Well, those are funny, whether they're real or not, they're funny. But here's the bad news, right? We did the good news, bad news the other day. But what's the bad news is people are really biblically illiterate. They don't know much about the Bible at all anymore. 100 years ago, people may not have been Christians, but they knew the Bible, right? They got it in school and they got it out in the public and they knew the Bible. But it's disappearing. And it's unfortunate. They do these surveys and studies. People say, oh yes, we still admire the Bible. They just don't read it. And so I thought maybe today we could talk about six different ways that you can talk to people who say, oh, well, good for you. You read the Bible. That's theologically interesting for you. Ho-hum. I don't want any part of it. But there are reasons that people should be reading the Bible that go beyond the theology. Now, of course, we're not saying the theology is unimportant. I mean, it's obviously really important for us as Christians. But what we're trying to do is get the door open, you know, just to say to people, look, don't worry about the theology. There's so many other good reasons at this point to start reading the Bible. And then they step through, right? They take that step in. And then, of course, the theology is going to get to them. I don't know if I told you this story before, but I've been teaching the Bible as literature out of Palomar, not as theology, as literature. And a guy out there became a Christian because of that. Not because of me, because the door was open, right? He had a chance to read the Bible, and he said, my life's a mess. He read the Bible, and he said, this speaks to me. This is true. And he's gung-ho ever since. So there are things that we can say to people, these six things, maybe, to get them at least interested and say, well, maybe I should pick that Bible up. Everybody's got one, right? They're sitting around somewhere in their house. It's not like you're asking them to invest a fortune. So that's what we're going to take a look at today. Does that make sense as far as six reasons just to get people reading? But they're not theological reasons. Okay. So number one, it's just good reading, isn't it? The Bible's great reading. I asked you the other week about some of your favorite Bible stories, and you all had some. Everybody's got favorite Bible stories. Favorite poems. We didn't talk about that last week. Do you have any favorite poems in the Bible that you like to go to? Probably in the Psalms? Mm-hmm. Any in particular you can think of?
Psalm 23.
Yeah, the 23rd Psalm is something that just about everybody knows. And it's got such great visual pictures. Doesn't the Lord is my shepherd? Not God is a guide. I mean, a guide doesn't make much sense, does it? You can't picture it, but the Lord is my shepherd. Now you see somebody, right? You've got a visual image of a shepherd and what a shepherd does and how stupid sheep are. That says something about us, I guess, of our nature. We used to live near sheep up in the high desert, and wow, are they stupid. You know, they fall into water that's this deep and drown, and just, you know, they get off the path, they fall over cliffs that are really obvious, and they go, whoa, and there they go. So, you know, I mean, there's pictures in the Bible, right? Those poems are terrific. But there's more than that, right? What about parables? There's some good parables in the Bible. Any parables stick out to you?
The lost sheep.
Parable of the lost sheep,
good
yes.
Samaritan.
The Good Samaritan story. In fact, did you notice that term has gotten into our language now? They pass laws called Good Samaritan laws. Well, it'd be nice if people knew the original story, right? My favorite's the prodigal son, because I feel very prodigal most of the time, right? You want God to have those arms out, don't you? And to be looking for you down the road, you know, as you come back to him. So these stories really stick with us. Parables stick with us. History. The Bible's full of good history. We don't think of it as a history book, but it is, isn't it? Remember we talked the other week about the sweep of history? You got the Assyrians coming through, and you got the Babylonians and the Persians and the people of Israel and what they're doing during all this time. So there's history in there. They're letters. They're really good letters. The only problem, which I don't think we talked about much last week, but one of the problems of them, but it's kind of fun, is you're only hearing one side of an issue, right? Paul's writing these letters, and you're wondering, why did he have to write this letter? Well, it's pretty obvious. He's really ticked at the Galatians. He says, come on, I was there. What are you guys doing? You're going back into legalism. But you got letters, right? Letters are kind of fun. You ever read Philemon? Little tiny one? It's a terrific letter. It's Paul trying to win over and propagandize this guy who's a slaveholder. It's a really interesting letter. He's pulling out all his rhetorical magic to try to make that guy take the slave back and not do hostile things to him. There are tragedies in the Bible. You think about tragedies, really, like Othello or Macbeth? Yeah. I mean, by definition, a tragedy is somebody who's fairly high up in society and has great promise, and then they crash and burn. You know, they just do something really awful. Well, look at the first king Israel had. Do you remember who that was?
Saul.
He had great promise, right? He had everything going for him. He was good looking, he was young, he was vigorous, and the nation turned to him. And what's he doing at the end? He's suiciding, right? He's dying on this hill. His sons are dead. He's consulting mediums. I mean, the whole thing is just so tragic by the time that story is over. How about Samson? Did he have promise? Oh, yeah, he was set aside, right? He's supposed to be a Nazirite. Not supposed to cut the hair, not supposed to do these certain things. And what does he do? He fritters it all away. Gets connected to people outside his culture, gets women from the Philistines. Not a good idea. These are pagans, you know? And he just ruins all of that. And so you get these awful stories of people that had so much promise. And you go, oh, kind of makes your stomach turn, right? Twists you a little bit on the inside. That's what a good tragedy does. It says, look out, right? If the good can fail, and the powerful can fail, you can fail, right? You don't have all of their tools and their abilities, you could fail. So you got tragedies. Do you have any comedies in the Bible? Well, not necessarily comedies like Laugh Out Loud or Slap Your Knee, kind of funny, although I think there are a couple. But by comedy, you mean somebody that's got real trouble, but they come out of it at the end of the story. The whole Bible is a comedy that way, right? Dante has something called a divine comedy. You don't laugh, right? Dante's not funny. But it's a comedy in the sense of troubles, but it gives way to good things. You know, you pull out of it. So the story of Ruth, that's a comedy, technically, right? Everything's okay at the beginning, and then the men die in the story, and they got to go back to the land. They got nothing. And then she marries the correct person, and all of a sudden she's in the genealogy of Jesus, right? So you got comedies in the Bible. By the way, I've got a minute here. One of my favorite comedies is the story of Balaam. Well, I mean, I know you think it's funny, but I mean, if you just use a little more imagination too to think about this story, Balaam is being told or being lured to go curse the children of Israel by the king of Moab, right? So what does he do? The Moab, and he agrees to do it. So the Moab king sends high ups, I think the princes of Moab, to escort him to where he can curse the children. So can you imagine on that trip? This is part where it starts getting funny to me. This guy is, Balaam is known as a good curser, right? If he puts a curse on you, something's going to wither, right? Something, you're in trouble. So can you imagine if you're one of those princes, you probably don't mess with this guy, right? You don't jostle him, you don't kid him, you don't want a withered arm out of this deal. So you kind of leave him alone and you treat him with great respect. Okay, is that a little funnier now that Balaam can't get his donkey to cooperate? And here are those princes looking back. Can you imagine from their perspective, they're watching this guy and the guy's beating on the donkey and the donkey's going here and there and pretty soon he's talking to the donkey. You're going, this guy's going to curse the Israelites? And so there's some funny stuff. Here's another one that strikes me as funny. Acts 23, I think it is. A group of guys say that they're going to never eat or drink until they kill Paul. There's a plot underway. And what happens? The Romans hear about it, and Paul's whisked out of the city. Now that cracks me up, because I always wondered, what happened to those guys after that? They're sitting in a bar, you know, drinking a tall one. Somebody says, wait a minute, you're part of that group. There are like 40 or 50 of them, something like that, big group. You said you weren't going to eat or drink until Paul was dead. Well, we're working on it. So, yeah, there's funny stuff in the Bible too, frankly, I think. So there's good reading, right? So if you can't get anybody interested in the Bible any other way, there's some of the best stories, best poetry, best of anything. In fact, in front of the UN building, it says a quote from Isaiah, right? It talks about beating swords into plowshares. So, I mean, Isaiah is considered a good poet. Just forget the theology. He's considered a really good poet. All right, so you could maybe win people over. Tell them, hey, take a look at the Bible. It's got good reading. What about worldly wisdom in there? Again, not theological wisdom, but just worldly wisdom. How can you operate in life successfully? So I passed out slips to, I think, five of you or six of you from the book of Proverbs. I thought we could just kind of dip in there real quickly. And of course, there's plenty more verses to look at. But somebody had, and I don't remember who I handed it out to you, but in chapter 8, verse 12, there's some wisdom. Who had Proverbs 8, 12?
Okay. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion.
You know what stuck out to me? Prudence and discretion. Does our society need a little more prudence and discretion these days? It's gone, right? It's just totally gone. Wouldn't it be great to instill that kind of stuff in young people? Prudence and discretion. Do you really need that credit card maxed out? Do you need that bigger house? You know, use a little prudence, right? Think ahead, plan these things. They used to name women prudence, right? Because you took values from the Bible and you made it a person, right? You're supposed to illustrate that the rest of your life. That's good advice there. Somebody else had chapter 9, verse 8.
Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you.
Reprove a wise man. We don't even know maybe that term these days. What does it mean to reprove somebody?
Correct
them, right? Correct them. People don't really want correction. I don't want correction. Nobody really likes it. But what does that say? A wise person says, oh, okay, I need to hear that. I'm not doing something quite right. I'll open my ears. I will not put the shield up, right? I'll hear you out, because that's how you get better. That's how you get to be a more well-rounded person, or kinder in your actions or the way you speak or whatever it is, right? We all need correction. Good to hear that once in a while. How about 11:12? Chapter 11, verse 12.
Whoever derides their neighbor has no sense, but the one who has understanding holds their tongue.
Honest to goodness, some of the biggest stupid things I've done in my life always involved me saying or emailing or doing something and hitting send. And then going,
send or send?
S-E-N-D. But after I do, I go, why did I do that? I just should have shut up. I just should have held my tongue, right? That's a virtue. What do they say? Better to be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. Yeah.
You sure don't want to send all.
No. I heard now, is that true that now there's some kind of deal that you can do with email that if you send something, you can pull it back within like 30 seconds?
It never worked.
Yeah, like 30 seconds?
It's a 5-second rule on stuff on the floor. Right? Yeah. I have mine set up so it won't send automatically when you hit send. You have to physically tell it to send what's in your outbox.
Oh.
So it gives you a little bit of time.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Now I have something flashes up there. Are you sure? Does this. 2 weeks from now, are you wanting to make sure this thing goes out there?
Really? Question.
Yeah, really? How about 12:1?
Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid.
That's pretty good. He who hates correction is stupid. And yet nobody likes correction. And yet we're supposed to do that in our families. We're supposed to be willing to take that ourselves. Pretty strong. 13:20. I'm sorry, 12:11. Do we do that one?
Yeah. He who works his land will have plenty of food, but he who follows worthless things lacks sense.
He who follows worthless things. To me, that's the world of fantasy. Isn't that big today? All the stars are people who live lives of fantasy. You know, in the old days, people used to admire doctors and nurses and people that made a difference in their society. Firefighters, whatever it is. And now it's all celebrities. I mean, talk about a fantasy world. And we're telling our kids, well, I don't know if we tell our kids that, but I mean, they just sort of gravitate to that, right? Everything's fantasy. Look at the lotteries. I couldn't believe California. Well, you know, there we go. But many states are not going to these lotteries, and it was promised that it would all go to the kids, right? Yeah, right. And I'm thinking, all you're doing is suggesting that people chase a fantasy. You have no chance. You're going to get hit by a meteorite before you're going to win the lottery. And yet people are going for that. And it's always the lower, it seems like, the lower income people that are desperate, you know, and they're going to go that direction. That doesn't seem like a good way to go in chasing fantasies. About 13:20.
He who watches the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm.
A companion of fools suffers harm. How many times can you look back, think about your own childhood growing up? Were you a companion of fools? There's something about hanging out with certain people, right? Who do you choose as your friends to hang out with? One last one here, 14:23.
In all labor there is profit, but idle chatter leads only to poverty.
Say that one more time. That's a good one.
In all labor there is profit, but idle chatter leads only to poverty.
You know that first part, especially in all labor there is profit? You know, it's the Christian worldview that really made labor something worthwhile. Up until then, it was the dregs of society worked, and you hated what you did, and it was the serfs, and it was this, and it was that. And Christianity came along, especially the Protestant Reformation. That's why they called it the Protestant work ethic, because they said, no, whatever you do, you're a cobbler, you do it to the glory of God, you're honoring God. And it was worthwhile. It didn't matter how, quote-unquote, menial or high up or whatever. Everything was a good piece of work. It was something that was ennobling for you, and it was good to represent God. So that's what that verse is talking about, the value of good hard work. So is there worldly wisdom in the Bible? Yes. And I'm just picking Proverbs. You know there are other books and sections that have some good wisdom as well. How about number three? Here it comes into my ballpark. I like literature. I better if I'm going to be an English major. And you take a look at some of the greatest literature ever written. Something like 1,300 allusions to the Bible in Shakespeare. 1,300. Jane Eyre has over 100 allusions to the Bible. How about something as in your face as the first three words of Moby Dick, famous book by Melville. Call me Ishmael. So now somebody who doesn't know the Bible says, okay, so now I know your name.
Yeah.
But if you knew Ishmael, what's his story?
Rejected.
Yeah. An outcast. Yeah. A wanderer. Kind of having to work by his own wits and survive. And so you meet this character, the very first three words, you already are starting, if you knew the Bible, you'd already start determining what kind of person this is going to be. This is not going to be a steady person. This is not going to be somebody who's got life easy, who's, you know, solid in the community. This is a wanderer. And so we already meet that from the very beginning, just by those three words. Hemingway's got a novel called The Sun Also Rises. Took that from Ecclesiastes. And if you look at that part of Ecclesiastes, it says, life is just a cyclical ho-hum. I've done it before. I'll do it again. I'm kind of burned out. And guess what? Hemingway? Yeah, most of his characters are burned out. They're doing the same thing over and over. They have no hope, no future, no nothing. They're just kind of going through the treadmill of life. I read a good science fiction story called The Earth Abides. That's from Ecclesiastes. Right, so these titles are there for a reason in many cases. And I just gave you a list of some of the other author. Steinbeck has something called East of Eden. Remember when they get kicked out to the East of Eden, right? So this is a story of people who are out of the garden in their lives. It's kind of a retelling of the Cain and Abel story as well. But I mentioned some. Milton, Dostoevsky, C.S. Lewis, Flannery O'Connor. The list just goes on and on. People that over and over again use the Bible. It doesn't mean they're all believers, but they use the Bible as kind of a shorthand, so you can begin to figure out what are the main struggles, what are the characters like. And it's not just literature, is it? I gave you some other areas. For example, music. Right? Some of the greatest music has been to the glory of God or inspired by biblical passages or whatever. I think it was, who's the one that signed? Bach. Bach signed his work always to the glory of God. Every page that he wrote, to the glory of God. Handel's Messiah gets sung every Christmas time, doesn't it? Man, it's just the Bible. He just wove all these passages together. And it was almost like he was in a trance. He was just like isolated for like 2 weeks, I think. Maybe you know the story better than I do. And he came out, and tears streaming down his face, and said it was like he saw God, you know, as he wrote this thing. But that was real inspiration. Again, I don't know if he was a Christian, but he used the Bible, and we still celebrate it today, don't we? Some of the best sculptures. The David. The Moses figure. probably some others. I'm a little blank. That's not my area. So, but you can think of all these and painting. We didn't talk painting. The Last Supper. It's a real shame. And then Da Vinci started messing around with a different way of putting paint on plaster as fresh or something, and so it's been peeling ever since. It was already starting to go in his lifetime. It's like, shoot, I wish they'd done a better job of it. But so you've got that. Any other paintings come to mind that would be biblically?
Rembrandt. The Prodigal.
Yeah.
Because that's amazing, because he has the father, the older brother, and the son in that painting. And it's really, when you look at that film, Henry Nouwen wrote a whole book about that. It's just phenomenal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Rembrandt really captured faces, didn't he? I mean, just the expression of faces. So what are we saying? Good literature. Any kind of form of good literary arts or poetry or whatever. In fact, if that's okay, you're a captive audience, I get to read a poem to you. Well, that's good. You're not heading for the exit, so that's a good sign. This is interesting. This is a collection of different authors over the years, hundreds of years, of poetry who have used the Bible for their inspiration. So I'm just going to pick one. It's a story that you know of, and I want to show you how it can be translated, how people can use their imagination to bring that story to life. And this is Lord Byron, the English poet back in the early 1800s. Obviously not a Christian. If you ever study his life, not a Christian. But I'm just saying he used the story. Do you remember the story? I think we talked about it last week, of the Assyrians that came down and they attacked Jerusalem and they set up a siege around it. But after a period of time, the angel comes by and they're all dead. And Sennacherib heads back to Assyria. So they broke the siege. Well, this is the story of that. It's called The Destruction of Sennacherib by Lord Byron. I like it because it's got a real wheeling rhythm. You're going to hear the rhythm of this thing. So I'm not going to give you some kind of bizarre poetry. This is fun stuff to read and to hear. The Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. Like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, that host with their banners at sunset were seen. Like the leaves of the forest when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow lay withered and strown. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed, and the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heaved and forever grew still. And there lay the steed with his nostril all wide, but through it there rolled not the breath of his pride, and the foam of his gasping lay white on the turf and cold as the spray of the rock-beating surf. And there lay the rider, distorted and pale, with the dew on his brow and the rust on his mail. And the tents were all silent, the banners alone, the lances unlifted, the trumpet unblown. And the widows of Asher are loud in their wail, and the idols are broke in the temples of Baal, and the might of the Gentile, unsmote by the sword, hath melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. That's strong, and I mean, that's really interesting. To me, I like that because it brings more of the Bible story to life. But there you go. So a lot of source of inspirations there. How about number four? Our language. Have you thought about how many of the things we say to each other, just daily, not when we're reading the Bible, but just things have leaked out of the Bible into a common way of talking? For example, let there be light. The University of California used to, I don't know if they changed it, they used to have on their seal those words, let there be light. Is it still there?
I'm not sure.
California, probably not.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. Let there be whatever you want.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. How about the Tower of Babel? We get the word babble.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody's just babbling. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. How about scapegoat? That's used in sports all the time. Somebody was a scapegoat. That's from Leviticus.
They don't know where that goes.
No.
No, I have no idea.
No. The Promised Land. Valley of the Shadow of Death. Inherit the Wind. They made a play out of that. Right? It's right from the Bible.
True.
Oh.
God bless you.
Yeah.
Let there be light is still there.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Good.
Yeah,
how about having feet of clay? You ever heard that one? Feet of clay. It's from Daniel.
Yeah.
Some of those images that he pictured having the feet of clay, not strong. Also from Daniel, handwriting being on the wall. Right? So it goes on and on. I won't spend the time. No rest for the wicked. Yeah. Yeah. Old Testament, New Testament. These things have come into our language. So what we say is influenced by the Bible. But more importantly, can we go to number six here? So maybe you convince people with those first five things. I hope so. But number six, this is the key thing about the Bible. It is the cornerstone book of the entire Western civilization. It is the book, more than any other book, that made the Western civilization what it is. So I just am running through a few things on here, and this would be worthy of a whole talk sometime, but the emphasis on the individual. Right? We're made in the image of God. That's a Judeo-Christian idea. We're made in the image of God. So the individual has great worth. And the individual, frankly, is allowed to stand up against the community. They did that back in the days of Acts, the book of Acts. Remember, they said, well, we got to obey God rather than man, because they were trying to put a law on them. Hey, you can't do this. And they said, I don't think so. And so we had protests, right, from that time on. Martin Luther King, what did he do? He got a lot of his inspiration from the Bible and that same idea of protesting. Your laws are unfair. Your laws are not good. I'm going to follow God rather than man. So you've got the focus on the individual. How about the elevation of women? Now, unfortunately, and again, this is worthy of a different talk, but unfortunately today the smear against Christianity is that it's degraded women, and it hasn't. It hasn't at all. If you look back, we won't have a lot of time, but if you look back in the book of Genesis, the beginning there, where Adam looks at Eve and says she'll be his helper, and a lot of people go, oh, good grief, here we go. The little lady from the 1950s, you know, rushing to her husband when he comes home from work and putting slippers on him and bringing him his pipe and getting his food ready, that's not what it means when it says helper. If you look later in the book of Psalms, the same word is used to talk about God being our helper. Right? So think of it more as an ally. That was really what they were talking about. The woman is to be the ally of the man, not the subservient little woman running around in the kitchen all the time, right? That's not the Judeo-Christian view. Now, what did Paul say in the New Testament? There's neither Greek nor Gentile nor male or female, right? So, and what's Jesus doing? He's hanging around talking to women a lot. And he's telling them it's better that you learn than you be in the kitchen. Right? The whole Mary Martha thing. He's talking to the woman in the Samaritan woman, right? First of all, he didn't talk to Samaritans, and he certainly didn't talk to Samaritan women, and he tells them, I'm the Messiah. He was way more direct with her.
And a woman sighing first in the resurrection.
Yeah, the women are the earliest eyewitnesses, which, by the way, makes you realize probably the New Testament stories are true, because if you're making up something, you wouldn't have the women go. Right? I mean, why would... Because women did not have, in that Jewish and the Roman world, did not have that high a position. It was a lower position. So if you're going to make this stuff up, you'd have Peter show up. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, somebody. But you wouldn't have the women show up. So you go, well, they'd only say that if it's true. Yeah, I think so. How about C, the freedoms we enjoy? Right? We have so many freedoms in this country. And it's because of the conscience and things like that. We're supposed to obey God, not man. What does it say in the Declaration of Independence? We're endowed by our Creator. Wow, that's amazing. It's not the state that gives you the right, according to the Judeo-Christian view. It's not the state. If the state gives it, the state can take it away. But if your rights come from God, that's a whole different matter, isn't it? And that was a real change, a real different way to see political matters. How about D, development of science? Once again, Christianity has been slapped with the idea that Christianity and science are at odds, that they fight. Absolutely not true. Where did science originate? In the Christian West. It didn't come out of Asia. It didn't come out of Africa. It didn't come out of anywhere else. It came out of the West because, go back to Genesis, we're created by God. God is a rational being. You know how he puts things together. It seems very logical and rational. He set these laws in place so then we can go examine them. Right? So a lot of the foundational understanding of what the world was like and what God is like allowed these people to go out and then had the optimism to think, we can figure this out, right? We have some attributes of God. We may not be as smart as God, but you know, he's given us some mental capacities. We can go out and figure out this world. Plus, we can cut a tree down, and that tree is not animated by some spirits, right? We're not hurting the world. God is separate from this world. And so it's okay. You can cut a tree down, or you can cut an animal open to look to see, you know, how things function. You're not going to get the gods mad at you. So there are a lot of reasons to think that science would come out of the West. And again, this is not just a Christian idea. There are non-Christians believe that and have stated that.
There's one here I read. Someone read about the pathways of the sea and discovered the currents in the ocean.
Yeah.
That you know, he was the first one to say, oh, then there must be and it was the currents, you know, the water goes this way, and so you can take a ship that way, and it goes back this way, so you can take it that way.
Yeah.
Because he saw the biblical passage about the pathways of the sea.
Right. How about the idea, if you read in Job and then Psalms and Isaiah, three different books, they talk about God stretching out the heavens. You know what that sounds like? 20th century, when they started realizing the universe is expanding. And so it doesn't say God created the stars or God placed the stars. It said God stretched out the heavens. It's the idea of opening a tent or an umbrella, kind of, you know, everything's moving out. It's like, wow, that's 20th century physics. It took them 2,000 years to figure out, you know, the Bible had it right in the first place. And then under E, the influence on laws, the influence on our politics. I mean, apparently, from what I've heard, is that to set up the three-part government that we have, you know, the judiciary and the presidency and the Congress, it was from King someplace where they split things into a three-part type of governance, right? So everything, politics, morality, economics, civil rights. Did you notice more than once when Martin Luther King was talking, he used the concept of having been to the Promised Land or seeing the Promised Land. And so the whole civil rights movement kind of wrapped itself up in the idea this is another Exodus. Because Martin Luther King, after all, everybody calls him Dr. Martin Luther King. He was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, right? He was a reverend. His speech, that famous I Have a Dream speech, what did he quote? Amos. He was using the book of Amos. And so even the idea of civil rights came out, was given a boost because of the Bible. I gave you two things at the bottom there. This was 41 outstanding teachers, right? These are not Christians. They were just surveyed. And they said knowledge of the Bible is crucial for good education, provides an educational advantage. Hey, everybody wants an educational advantage. There it is, right? Know the Bible. Chairs of secular colleges said you want one book to help your kids as they come into college, have them read the Bible. That'll put them a step ahead of the others. So I like this quote. I forgot where I got it, but it says, the Bible is the learned man's masterpiece, the ignorant man's dictionary, the wise man's directory. Let me share a couple of other quotations. I just didn't have a lot of space there, but William James, a well-known psychiatrist and psychologist, he said, the Bible contains more exquisite beauty, more morality, more important history, and finer strains of poetry and eloquence than can be collected from all other books. Do you recognize the name Buckley, William Buckley? He was a political... Okay, he had a brother, lesser known. He was a speech teacher and would help people do real well in front of others. His name was Reed Buckley. He was a trainer for professional speakers. He said if somebody doesn't read the Bible, quote, he or she is irreparably ignorant and culturally deprived. Wow.
Well, don't sugarcoat it.
Yeah. So... I thought maybe if you had some questions or if you've got somebody that you say, well, I know somebody would like to, you know, that may be interested in the Bible, but they bog down in Leviticus. You know, they start out, they got great intentions, you know, and they can go through Genesis because those are great stories and Exodus is pretty good. And then they're just dead by Leviticus. So what I did, and I've got it at home, and you, if you email me, I'll be glad to send it to you. It's, I think it's only one page, but it tells kind of the Bible story like we did last week, but in parentheses, it puts the chapters that you could pick those parts of it up. So it does maybe a fifth of the Bible. And so to me, it's the fifth that really is good stuff. You know, it's like the story of the Jews and the story of Jesus, but it's less threatening, right? And so you can get people, if they're interested and they're kind of curious about the Bible, say, well, I wouldn't even know where to start. You say, start here. So I'll be glad to send that to you if you'd like to have that.